Okay, I'd like to call the meeting, the Environment and Natural Resources Policy Committee to order, and also we have with us several other committees, the Senate Environment, Energy and Natural Resources Committee, House Agriculture Committee, Rural Economics and Veterans Affairs Finance, House Energy Finance and Policy, the House Transportation and Transit Policy. And we have with us today helping to, we have several chairs here as well that are, I'm pleased to have with us, and we are going to be discussing today the Low Carbon Fuel Standard Bill, which Representative Bowe has brought forward, and I would like to, I guess, extend an invitation to any others that would like to testify on this, but we have several today. We're going to be testifying for about 5 minutes. We did have an expert that was coming in from California who we're not sure where he is right now, Dr. Farrell. So we hope
American Airlines.
So we hope that he does make it to here eventually during the testimony, but we will extend to him if he does arrive 30 minutes to be heard to testify on what's taking place in California at this time. With that, I guess I would like to open it up to Representative Moe, if you'd like to begin the presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I want to thank you all for getting up at a relatively early hour. Some of us have been working late on conference committee bills, and I appreciate you showing up early. My counterpart here is Senator Kathy Sharon, who is working with me on this. We think this is a very innovative approach to reducing the carbon output in the state of Minnesota. I saw this, many of us saw this, a presentation last session on the California proposal, Schwarzenegger introduced by executive order. Effectively, the bill that you have in your folder on reducing the carbon output from the fuels in the state of California by 10%. It's a market-based approach to accomplish this. It's not picking winners and losers. It's not investing in obsolete technology. It's saying, based on how much carbon is released in the production of the fuel, we will force these fuels to compete on the marketplace. Being from the north, this is very interesting for me because forest products obviously are going to be a part of this picture, and we want to make sure that that we're represented, but also all across the state, there's a lot of opportunities for us to reduce our carbon output by looking at the fuel portion. I want to just recognize a few chairs that are here from the House side. Our chair of Ag Finance, Al Junkie, Ag Policy, Mariano Tremba, Transportation Policy, Chair Hornstein, who I'm trying to be as frank with as I can. And also the co-chair of the meeting, Senator Stavre, who has also been supportive of this bill. I appreciate that. Representative Hilty, our energy finance chair, I didn't see him back there. Thank you for showing up and for bringing your committee. With that, I'll turn it over to the Senator briefly. Go.
Well, I really do not have anything further to add except thank you very much for organizing this event and hosting us here. I appreciate the House inviting us all here to hear the information that helps us understand the value of the low carbon fuel standards. So I know that I look around the table and I see many faces that I know, of course, in the Senate and many that I've come to know and work with in the course of the last couple of sessions. And I'm happy to be here with you. And there are others of you here that I don't know as well, but look forward to our work together on this important issue that we're confronting.
To begin with, I'd like to introduce Bill Grant and Shalini Gupta from the Isaac Walton League, who I've been working with it on this presentation and on this bill. They've actually been far more active and organized than I have, so I appreciate their work. And they're going to lead the presentation from now on, but there'll be several other speakers that we'll have a chance to ask questions of. So, Shalini, Bill.
Welcome, Mr. Grant. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of numerous committees, and thanks to Representative Moe and Senator Sharon. I'll give just a couple of brief introductory remarks. Because we're without our featured speaker, Shalini Gupta from my staff will be giving the presentation that Dr. Farrell was planning to give. We do have access to papers from Dr. Farrell that we can make available to people in lieu of his being here today. I think members know that transportation is a big deal when it comes to greenhouse gas emissions. They account for about a third of the global warming emissions in Minnesota. Generally speaking, we think of three ways to reduce greenhouse gas emissions from the transportation sector. First of those is to reduce fuel demand through transportation and land use planning. In other words, to reduce the number of vehicle miles traveled. Second way generally is to reduce emissions from vehicle tailpipes. Representative Hortman has a bill on that important issue. And the third way of going about this is to lower the greenhouse gas content of the fuels we consume. I would suggest that all these strategies are needed, but the policy we're discussing here today, the Low Carbon Fuel Standard, focuses on that third strategy of reducing the greenhouse gas content of the transportation fuels we put in our cars and trucks. The concept of a low carbon fuel standard is an idea being explored at the federal level as part of global warming discussions going on now in Congress. It is also about to be implemented in California, and there are other states considering it as well. This is a solution that was recommended by the Minnesota Climate Change Advisory Group, as well as the Next Generation Energy Board, and is also part of the platform of the Greenhouse Gas Accord that Governor Pawlenty and five other governors signed in November. The Minnesota Climate Change Advisory Group analysis showed that a low-carbon fuel standard could result in potentially large greenhouse gas reductions and play an important role in meeting Minnesota's global warming targets. Minnesota, we believe, should engage in a more in-depth analysis of the costs and benefits of a low-carbon fuel standard so that that policy can be designed in a way that really benefits the state, and we also hope in a way that would allow us to work with our neighbors in surrounding states and even at the national level. As you're going to hear in coming testimony, the low-carbon fuel standard is worthy of a further study here in Minnesota. We need to look at those costs and benefits of a policy to see how well it might benefit Minnesota going into the future. Really, this is a policy that could work to reduce Minnesota's global warming emissions, diversify our transportation and fuel supply, reduce the risk to the state's economy from global energy price shocks, and grow our state's clean energy industry. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to introduce our next speaker. But before I do that, just give you a brief overview of the rest of the morning. We're going to hear from Mike Bull with the Office of Energy Security and Mark Lindquist from the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources, two of the agencies that we've been in conversation with about a low-carbon fuel standard. Then Shalini Gupta from my staff will give the main presentation about what a low-carbon fuel standard is and how we see it perhaps working here in Minnesota. Later in the morning, we'll also hear from Bill Lee with Central Valley Ethanol Co-op and former State Senator Steve Kelly, now with the Humphrey Institute, about a study that we're hoping to do in the interim and bring back to the legislature next year for your further consideration so that the bills that Representative Moe and Senator Sharon have now introduced could perhaps be considered at that point. So with that, Chairman, I'd like to bring Mike Bull up to the table. Because
Mr. Bull would like to step forward. Welcome, Mr. Bull.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Mike Bull. I'm the Deputy Director of the Minnesota Office of Energy Security at the Minnesota Department of Commerce. And I do want to thank you for holding the hearing today and inviting me to speak. This is an issue that I think we'll all be working on strenuously over the coming few years. And I think this is a fairly historic occasion to have you all you august folks together to talk about this. We spent quite a bit of time this summer and fall working and discussing this issue, we being the Next Generation Energy Board. I've had a, in your packet, I've included the relevant piece of the Next Gen Energy Board's report to the legislature on and a recommendation around this low carbon fuel standard and direction for a study to move forward on that. The Next Gen Board, as you all know, there are a number of you sit on the board, Representative Hilty, Representative Junkie, and others. The it's an entity that was created in last year's ag finance bill. I think the genesis of the idea came from Representative Junkie and sort of helped to shape it. We are five state agencies, Commerce, PCA, Natural Resources, BEAD, and Agriculture. We have a number of key legislators and representatives from the ag community and environmental community and academia. And we looked at this issue of the low carbon fuel standard and basically started from the proposition that Minnesota has already, for a number of years now, has led the nation with regard to the production and use of low carbon fuel. With our E10 requirements, now E20, we're working to implement E20, our B2 biodiesel, 2% biodiesel required, on the cusp of passing another Next Gen Energy Board recommendation, the B20 bill this session. We lead the nation in E85 availability. So we see this as a good opportunity to support our current biofuels programs and start to use this as potentially as a mechanism to move it to those next generation fuels, to strengthen the core of our biofuels programs and move beyond to what we see as the future, which include biomass-based ethanol and algae-based biodiesel, and we see that this could be a mechanism to do that. You know, I think good to point out that when I talk about strengthening the core of our current biofuels program, what I mean by that is that we have a number of producers in the state that are working hard to reduce the fossil inputs to their current ethanol production. And you'll hear from Bill Lee today, one of the foremost thinkers on these issues, and actually working to, the idea is to reduce their fossil input to their ethanol production, thereby decreasing their carbon content. And we're making some of the most renewable ethanol in the world here in Minnesota. At CVEC out at Benson, CMEC in Little Falls, Winnebago's facility was recently recognized. They've added some biomass combustion to offset their natural gas use and some wind production to offset some of their electrical grid electricity. So it's something that's happening already in the state, and I think that this could be a potential mechanism to move beyond where we are now. I guess one more point I'd like to make is that as we discussed this within the Next Gen Board, it was critical to us that we understand the impacts of a low carbon fuel standard. It's a fairly complicated mechanism. It has to be based on good science and good data. We have to know what the impacts are at the pump for consumers. We have to know what the impacts are for our biofuel industries. We have to know what the impact would be on our local refiners. We have a couple of, and we benefit from, Minnesota consumers do, our refiners in the state, and we have to be cognizant of the impact on them and on our petroleum retailers as well. A further note is in the Senate on the B20 bill, the Senate has included $200,000 to fund a low carbon fuel study based on the Next Gen Energy Board recommendation. If for whatever reason that mechanism, that funding mechanism, really go forward, we'll find at the department, at the Office of Energy Security, in our renewable energy research budget, we'll find some money to move that study forward either way. So with that, members, I'll stand for any questions, and thank you again for inviting me to speak.
Thank you, Mr. Bull. And Representative Hornstein has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Bull, you talked about inputs into the process for making biofuels. And I know a couple of years ago we had a lot of conversations about coal to fire plants. And I'm aware of at least one coal-fired ethanol plant in the state. Are you aware of others? And does that concern you in the context of our discussion today?
Chair, Representative Hornstein, there may be others that are thinking of that. A low carbon fuel standard would make the production of coal fired ethanol, it would give a market disadvantage to those production of those fuels. And so I think that is something to be cognizant of.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Mr. Bull? Okay. Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Bull. And next, Mr. Lindquist.
Thank you.
Welcome, Mr. Lindquist.
Good morning, and thank you to the chair and to the committee for the opportunity to come and speak today. My name is Mark Lindquist. I'm the Biofuels Program Manager for the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources, and I was asked to come and testify today on how these biofuels and low-carbon fuel standard policies may impact positively and negatively, potentially, on the forest portions of the state and the forest products industries. I'm not here to speak for the forest products industry, but I will make remarks more or less that are consistent with the July 07 report by the Governor's Task Force on the Competitiveness of the Primary Forest Products Industry, and we provided some handouts to you that highlight the energy section of that report. As Mr. Bull was indicating, a low-carbon fuel standard would tend to favor biofuels, and it would tend to favor biofuels with the lowest carbon footprint. We see that likely cellulosic ethanol would fit into that framework, as would a biomass-fired first-generation ethanol plant. And this is where we start linking and relating this to the forest products industry in northern Minnesota. And we'd have three basic points to make. One is this can create an economic opportunity for the rural part of the state that's forested. There's opportunities for improved management and improved forest health. There are also a couple of concerns and caveats that I would mention. On the economic opportunity, we've all clearly seen the benefits that the corn ethanol industry and the biodiesel industry have brought to the agricultural portion of rural Minnesota. And as we look forward and start looking at the potential for cellulosic ethanol and those industries to emerge, the forested portion of rural Minnesota has some opportunities to provide material and create value-added products from our timber resource as well. And we can look at the pulp and paper industry as a very interesting place where the cellulosic ethanol industry has a great deal of potential to integrate with those existing pulp and paper operations. It's fairly exciting. In terms of forest health and forest management, creating new markets for a more diverse set of woody biomass provides resource managers with more tools to manage the forest. That allows us to get into the woods at different times and in different places to remove materials and pursue management activities that can improve the health and productivity of our forests. Excuse me. Now, the Department of Natural Resources manages our state forests for a variety of benefits and resource values, including ecological values, ecological diversity, recreational opportunities, whether it's hunting, whether it's hiking, whether it's wildlife observation, and as well as, of course, we manage for fiber. And all of these uses and values require healthy forests, and by seeing these emerging energy markets, they can utilize wood resources that are not traditionally utilized by the traditional industries. We can enact some management that can drive forest health forward. So we are excited to see the opportunities on the horizon emerge for forest management in and around these energy issues. Finally, there's certainly some caveats and concerns that would be reflected in the governor's task force. Logging, pulp and paper, other forest products, milling operations are energy intensive, and those managers and facility managers and entrepreneurs are concerned about energy costs. So certainly something that impacts the cost of transportation and logging operations would be a concern to those folks. There's some concern about not wanting to subsidize one use of the traditional round wood, so that policy in effect bids wood away from the traditional industries into a new industry, in putting some of those existing employers in further economic difficulty with the housing market downturn. Our wood products mills are not doing as well as we'd like. In fact, there are several that are shut down with hundreds of folks out of work on that. So we think there's opportunities to manage around that competition for round wood, as it were, using small diameter wood, species of lesser value, pre-commercial thinning, fire management, and so forth. So, but that's one concern that industry representatives have expressed. So those are the perspectives on a low carbon fuel standard from the forest management and forest industry perspective that I was asked to share with you today, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
Any questions? Representative Mo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Lindquist, I appreciate your presentation. As you know, I'm from the north, and this issue is important to us. The last thing that you touched on, wanting to make sure we don't increase competition for larger logs. I mean, as you know, there's the peaks and valleys, and the forest products industry is pretty challenging for us. So you would suggest that there's available capacity for us to use to be diverting some of that to energy generation without further exacerbating the peaks and valleys that we've experienced in the recent years?
We think there are some resource opportunities out there. Pre-commercial thinning, red pine stands, for example, can improve the productivity of those stands, make biomass available for the energy industries, as well as improve the volume and quality of the saw logs available to folks like potlatch. There's logging residues that there's some availability of. There's species of lower value. We have some stands that are low quality timber that the existing industries don't want, and there's opportunities that the energy markets can utilize those resources and allow us to get in and manage those sites and improve their productivity and health.
Representative Mo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one other question then. And do you think we can do so without significant ecological consequences? I mean, these are lands that are impacted already in a fairly aggressive timber management. I mean, do you see that this would help or hurt that in any way?
Mr. Chair and Representative Mo, we're confident that we can provide additional timber resources without detrimental ecological impacts. And in fact, one of the reasons that we're excited about some of these opportunities is that we think we can provide some ecological benefits. First, keep in mind that the department manages our public lands, as do most of the counties, and many of the private landowners with some pretty rigorous attention to detail when it comes to ecological values. We're certified by two independent certification agencies. We adhere to the site level guidelines for the harvest of timber. The state of Minnesota, through the Forest Resources Council, has developed and adopted the first in the nation standard for biomass harvest. So there's some rigorous protections around what we do. But the second thing is that we have the opportunity to look at sites and decide and see where there's some ecological opportunities that we're missing, and go in and manage those sites, replant, provide a broader range of diversity, and manage for those ecological values.
Representative Cornish.
Just to remind the committee that the same thing could happen to the loggers that did to the farmers down here, that we made the estimates about corn ethanol. It was plenty to go around, and now the farmers are getting blamed because they're taking advantage of the ethanol market and causing our food price to go up, and we make a shortage of timber, then the loggers are going to get blamed for causing the timber and the lumber prices to go up. And so it sounds good that there's plenty of wood to go around when we're looking at it now, but we thought that too with corn ethanol. I just wondered if you thought about that, the projections. And
Mr. Lindquist.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cornish, that's a very fair point. We have. There are real concerns about how big the wood basket is, and obviously the industry has been concerned about what the potential competition for that round wood is, and it's certainly our intent to keep realistic expectations about what the forests can provide. We want to manage for those. We want to try to manage those cost issues and not drive the price of round wood out and above what can sustain the traditional industry, though to some extent the market will equalize some values, and we've seen some European companies look at potentially exporting a great deal of round wood in the form of pellets to the European Union, and if that's what the market demands, that will shift prices and so forth. But we're very cognizant of the wood supply and do work with industries and processors on studies to make sure that as they move forward, they have the opportunity to understand what the resource is and what's available and at what kind of cost structures.
Representative Cornish, have a follow-up?
It might be a bigger question than you can answer, but what guarantee do we have that we aren't going to have to subsidize woody crops or cellulosic, any type of the other ethanol that we come up with? And so we're going to have the same problem with you now, people whining about the subsidies that the farmers are getting. We're going to have to subsidize just about anything we start out with, aren't we? I mean, whether it's forest products used for, you know, biomass or whatever we come into, aren't we going to have to start out by subsidizing it pretty heavy?
Mr. Lindquist.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cornish. Certainly, starting up new industries, there's always interest in using the various policy tools to initiate that. This is one of the things that the Low Carbon Fuel Standard potentially allows, is creating the market that helps pull these new technologies into the marketplace. Further, we did appropriate last year a modest amount of money to the Next Gen Energy Board that is available for capital grants and feasibility studies to help launch the next generation of biofuels.
And Representative Moe, to this point?
My point was just made when
okay.
This is a market-based approach that would allow for the fluctuation of that.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Moe. And Representative Saylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was just wondering if the testifier sees any reasonable opportunity or any feasibility for incorporating some of the invasive species such as buckthorn into the woody biomass feedstock. Just what are the opportunities there, if indeed there are any?
Mr. Lindquist.
Mr. Chair, Representative Saylor, we surely hope there's opportunities to improve our management, and one of those opportunities would be the removal of unwanted species in places. As an example, the legislature provided $500,000 to the department's Division of Ecological Resources to make woody biomass available to St. Paul District Energy as a part of ecological restoration and management. And one of the things that we're doing in that case is looking at, can we remove unwanted invasive species, disease trees, and other ecological restoration opportunities while providing district energy additional fuel resources. So we think so, but we have to be mindful and cognizant that going into, say, a stand that is buckthorn infested sometimes is expensive management. The wood may not pay for the management, but the wood can help reduce the cost of that management in some cases, like in a state park or so on. So there's certainly opportunities to remove exotic species and help manage those issues with biomass production.
Thank you. And Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for the testifier, I'm just kind of curious. I've got a lot of family members that are in the logging industry, and I'm wondering, as I watch those operations, there seems to be a lot of logging slash left in the woods, and how close are we to a market point where it would be worth their while to use that logging slash for cellulosic uses?
Mr. Lindquist.
Mr. Chair, Representative Scalzi, there's certainly, we're at this point in stage where there's lots of excitement, lots of interest, lots of talk that's somewhat ahead of the market realities, but they're certainly moving forward. As you look at the Laurentian Energy Authority, as we look at some of the Minnesota power-based opportunities, including the potential Alaskan 3 wood-fired project, we're seeing more market for that material emerge, and we're seeing more loggers buying the kind of a grinding equipment and other equipment necessary for the removal of that material. And again, though, we expect it to, for sure on state lands and on county lands and hopefully on other private lands, that slash will be utilized consistent with the biomass harvest guidelines. So we're leaving enough organic material for the soil and other residue for various plant and animal communities to continue to thrive.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you, Chairman. I would like to draw your attention to Senator Ellen Anderson, who has joined us from the Senate. She chairs the Environment Finance Committee, sitting right next to the chair of the Environment Committee, Senator Chaudhry.
I apologize for being late.
But I didn't mean to draw attention to that. My question, you started to talk a little bit to my question, but you made reference to the Forest Resource Council has a standard for biomass harvesting. I suppose it's a lengthy document or a standard, but could you give the essence of what that standard is and what it speaks to in relationship to what we're talking about here?
Mr. Chair and Senator Sharon, it is a fairly lengthy document. My recollection is about 20, 30 pages in length. I'm looking over to our assistant director of forestry for backup here, but I haven't been involved in the production of those guidelines, so I'm not deeply familiar. It has to do with the amount of residue that's left behind, the amount of standing snags that are left behind, practices utilized in terms of what the footprint of the harvest is. But we'd be happy to get you information on that if you'd like so.
Thank you very much. My question really might better be asked to say, because I think we share the concern about the forests and the harvesting and what happens to the forest. So is this a document that already is in place or could be improved that would address these kinds of questions about protections to the forest when we make this product a part of the market-based mm-hmm. system?
Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, the biomass harvest guidelines are approved and in place and have been printed and are being distributed to resource managers, loggers, and others. They're new. The biomass harvest is emerging, and there's a process that's going to have to be pursued in order to review and evaluate how the standards work, what the issues are, and then ultimately be reviewed and modified as appropriate based on experience in the field.
And Senator Chaudhry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I think those biomass standards, those guidelines that you just referenced, are probably the linchpin to all these questions you're getting. Are those guidelines something you can summarize, or are they a big book that would need to be explained in separate testimony at some point?
Mr. Lindquist.
I would suggest, Mr. Chair and Senator Chaudhry, I would suggest that probably having the Forest Resources Council and some of our forestry people explain those at a different hearing would be more appropriate. It's sort of beyond my capacity to do them justice.
Mr. Chair, in that case, let me just ask the question. I think this kind of summarizes some of the questions you've been getting. How do we make sure that the things we want to make sure are harvested, and the things that we want to preserve are not harvested? And then one question after that.
Mr. Chair and Senator Chaudhry, I think this might be a suitable time for me to ask Bob Tomlinson to join me and respond to some of those questions. Bob is our Assistant Director of the Division of Forestry.
Welcome, Mr. Tomlinson.
Thank you, Bob Tomlinson with the DNR Division of Forestry. Senator Chaudhry and members, the guidelines aren't intended to necessarily suggest which to harvest and which not to harvest. Rather, how to harvest, I think, would be the better way of looking at it. There's a number of planning plans that are in place through our subsection forest resource management planning efforts, where we go out and analyze and assess what the available timber should be in a given subsection throughout the state. And from that, we come up with what we refer to as annual stand and sham lists. The forestry folks go out and visit on the site about 75,000 acres a year of state forest lands. And from that, we offer harvest from about 30 to 35,000 acres each year. And that's all through a process, an interdisciplinary team process with the ecological service folks, the forestry folks, and the fish and wildlife people in the department working together to kind of come up with those sites and make sure that we're coming up with the right sites to harvest the right volumes and species and to get the type of values that Mr. Lindquist referred to. The guidelines are just a chapter, if you will, that are inserted into the best management practices that we are following. And we can make those available to you. Those are dictating more how we accomplish that work than once the decisions are made.
So then, Mr. Chair, I guess now that you're here, there are some questions along the lines of what you just said earlier. Do your activities then involve things like buckthorn or other invasive species? Do your managers take those into account in your harvest?
Mr. Chair, Senator Chaudhry and members, absolutely. If we're aware of situations where there's buckthorn is invading the stand, we may want to get in there and take a bit more assertive approach, and get that buckthorn removed out. And that should be part of the prescription, if you will, the silvicultural prescription to restore that site to good ecological health. And the other thing I think to keep in mind is that you folks here at the legislature have funded the Division of Forestry the last couple of years for native plant community inventory work. What we're trying to do is get make our sure that our recommendations are in line with what the sites are able to support and the native plant community inventory is kind of the basis for that, in which we're working forward on each year, and as well working on invasive species management and putting in places different things to help preclude movement of seed around, you know, that we don't want movement, those sorts of things. So,
so Mr. Chair, the question was with respect to biofuels. So you're saying that buckthorn, for example, is harvested and then used as a biofuel under your current programming?
Mr. Tomlinson? Mr. Chair, Senator Chaudhary, I'm not suggesting that, but I think that that's a fairly likely scenario that would play out as the biofuel market continues to emerge.
Okay. The last question, Mr. Chair, is to either witness. What in your activities, rules, guidelines, policies, or other agencies' rules, guides, activities, policies, guidelines, whatever, prevents a forest, for example, to be harvested for biofuels and then replanted with another species, for example, a hybrid poplar, which is a, you know, very popular species for biofuels?
Mr. Chair, members, the state, I'm trying to recall, I don't believe that under the current certification that we have with the FSC that we would be allowed to plant hybrid poplar trees in natural state forest land areas. I might be wrong in it, but I think that's kind of the approach, and that would prevent us or preclude us from doing that. Certainly there's areas we work a lot with farmers in western in Minnesota and other places where we help them establish hybrid poplar plantations and the like, and I wouldn't rule out that hybrid poplars might be something in some parts of the forested parts of the state, but I believe that the FSC certification precludes that from occurring on state forest lands. I'm not 100% certain on that, but not
private.
Not private.
Thank you, Mr. Tomlinson. We have one more question, and then I think we'll move on to the overall, the overview. Senator Scogin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess to either of you, as the forest industry is drawn further into next-gen production, do you have a conversation or a game plan about where some of these next-gen plants might be sited?
Mr. Lindquist?
Mr. Chair, Senator Scogin, certainly we try to be mindful of what's our role as a state agency and be mindful of what market decisions made by companies and entrepreneurs. That said, there are some logical places. Pulp and paper mills are, particularly the craft mills, are most naturally suited to integrating next-gen biofuel production. There's already a black liquor resource that would be a low-cost entree into that realm. There's some efforts that the University of Minnesota is doing with the removal of hemicellulose from the wood chips prior to pulping and so forth. So there's some logic and market conditions that would tend to favor those sites. And certainly as entrepreneurs come forward and are thinking about these kinds of projects, oftentimes they will contact us and work with us on assessing some of the forest resources to make sure there's an adequate supply of resource to support their plans and their businesses.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Lindquist and Mr. Tomlinson. Next we have, to testify, we have Ms. Shalini Gupta, who's going to give us an overview here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. We're just waiting to get the presentation set up. In the meantime,
just wanted to let you know I'm the Senior Energy Associate at the Isaac Blount League of America, and while it's unfortunate that Dr. Farrell couldn't join us, as you can see, there's a wealth of information here in the state on this issue as we're developing our knowledge on the low-carbon fuel standards. I wanted to bring your attention to a fact sheet that's in your packet that could help guide you through the presentation a little bit. It answers a very basic question about what a low-carbon fuel standard is and sort of what the rationale is for moving forward with it. I'm going to be giving a presentation that Dr. Farrell had given in early March as an overview. It's not necessarily Minnesota-focused, but we can talk through that. And while I can't say I'll be able to answer all of your questions, I will definitely try, and we can even ask other testifiers that have testified today if they could talk a little bit and answer to your questions. So as an LCF, a low-carbon fuel standard overview, here is a chart that looks at the California targets. And the green diamonds are show the global warming reduction targets that California has set for itself, which are very similar to Minnesota's. And the black line you see there are sort of the current emissions path. And so they have proposed a suite of options to try and reach these targets. And their climate change strategy has three overarching goals. One is to deploy near-term technologies to cut emissions by 25% by 2020, to stimulate innovation and investment in new technologies needed to meet the 2050 stabilization targets, which Minnesota's is 80% reduction by 2050, and contribute to related objectives, including economic growth, air quality, affordable energy prices, and diversity of energy sources. So California has developed a very comprehensive portfolio of energy policies to deal with it, with the low-carbon fuel standard being one of the policies that they're looking at. So they're looking at an energy research portfolio, efficiency standards for buildings and appliances, looking at potentially a cap-and-trade type system for electricity and other sources, as well as other carbon adder type policies for the electricity sector. For transportation, they're looking at better vehicles, such as the clean car standard, better fuels, which is the low-carbon fuel standard, and then also better transportation systems and planning, as well as other sort of land use manure management type practices. So a low-carbon fuel standard, as it's been structured in California, it focuses on the fuel that is going into a vehicle. So this is not, it's not a vehicle standard. It's actually looking at the petroleum-based fuels or whatever other fuels that could be used. And by that, it's not just a biofuel type alternative that could be used to meet a low-carbon fuel standard. It could also use electricity and other types of alternative fuels, such as hydrogen and compressed natural gas. You could also, by changing the carbon profile of how we refine petroleum, conventional types of fuels could also be used to meet the low-carbon fuel standard. So this is not just focused on biofuels as a means of compliance. So the targets that California has established is a 10% reduction in carbon intensity by 2020. So it regulates entities are those that manufacture fuels, such as refineries, and their purpose is to contribute to the overall target goals of reducing their emissions to 1990 levels by 2020. So the CARB, which is the California Air Resources Board, is in the process of developing regulations right now. They're coming out with them at the end of this year. and they're looking at some of the challenging decisions or the questions they're working with right now is, which fuels will be covered, how do you treat light-duty diesel, how to treat electric vehicles, and multimedia sustainability issues, as well as how to deal with land use issues in relation to some biofuels. So as I said before, they're going through the rulemaking process that's currently underway. For those seeking more information on the low carbon fuel standard, this is a website, and it's also on that fact sheet that everybody has available. It's expected to be enforceable in 2010 and then in full effect in 2020. So this is a standard, it's 10% reductions in carbon intensity by 2020 over a period of time. So there's intermittent goals in between. So why is the low carbon fuel standard needed? An economy-wide program will be necessary to achieve different outcomes. So you need an economy-wide system, but there are also many market imperfections that exist. So you need additional policies in addition to a market-wide system. Issues include some spillover issues with inadequate R&D, inability of government to make credible long-term commitments, market power issues with the petroleum industry, coordination, some externality issues of air pollution, energy security, and some distributional effects relating to equity issues. Also, the transportation system tends to lack U.S. alternatives in terms of a fuel-on-fuel that competition that you can directly replace with. There are many ways of complying with a low-carbon fuel standard. So, as I mentioned before, compliance is possible with many competing technologies, biodiesel and ethanol just being a few, and you could also include refinery efficiency and electricity, hydrogen, or buying credits in such a system. All fuel inputs are assigned a carbon intensity, and by carbon intensity, that means the unit of carbon in a certain gallon or unit of energy or fuel. And this carbon intensity is measured on a life cycle basis. So that's really an important aspect of a low carbon fuel standard. Different fuels have different carbon profiles depending on how they're grown, extracted, transported, and finally refined into a fuel for transportation vehicles. So for example, we have a difference with, even among corn ethanol facilities, coal corn ethanol facilities will have a different carbon profile than biomass-fired corn ethanol facilities. You can have different carbon profiles, even with conventional transportation fuels, depending on where they're sourced and how they're transported from what distances. So a low-carbon fuel standard looks at that entire gamut of issues, from well to wheels, as they call it, or from wheel to wheels. So it looks at the entire life cycle. I'm going to skip through a few. On key challenges for an LCFS, the low-carbon fuel standard, I would also just look at this in terms of what are some of the key questions that the university or a study should be looking at as we move forward. How does it integrate with other climate change policies that we're looking at here in Minnesota? How does it integrate with cap and trade or other regional type policies, other biofuel policies that we've already put into effect? What are some potential leakage or shuffling effects, including change in trade patterns, global emissions, and how to actually structure it in a way that it will result in innovation. International trade issues, a lot of developing countries will want to sell low carbon fuels in order to meet our standards. How do we deal with that, especially in the national policy framework on how we're dealing with tariffs right now in relation to biofuels? With the life cycle analysis that I was talking about, the well-to-wheel study, there are some uncertainties associated with that a lot of researchers are trying to identify right now. And an issue of indirect land use as well has come up. And the implications of international trade agreements will be needed, and the research and development of regulatory tools are also needed. So I'm going to actually stop there and open it up for questions. It's sort of a very overarching overview of a low-carbon fuel standard, and considering this was a more technical presentation than I believe Dr. Farrell had intended to present to you. I wanted to make sure I answer your questions wherever you're thinking about right now on this.
Thank you. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I wanted to go to the carbon intensity and the fuel cycle basis a bit. And I was looking at the bill, and it has all energy inputs and emissions, and you mentioned some wells to feed. I'm trying to think of oil here and how we measure the carbon intensity of oil. If you have exploration for drilling, and you have drilling in, let's say there's drilling in Saudi Arabia, and then transport here to the refinery in Minnesota, where does the clock start, and how would you measure the clock as far as the life cycle? Seems to be with oil, you know, which is now at what, 110 or 112 a barrel on regular cost, the carbon cost would be even higher when you start to measure the transport of the oil to the pump.
Within the California regulatory system, how they're trying to handle that is by assigning default values to certain types of extraction. So you don't necessarily have to track every single point in that process, but depending on distance traveled or default values on what emissions are expected from an average extraction process, they will use default values in that sense. And if a company can prove that they are better than the default values, it is upon the company to state that.
And Representative Portman.
Thank you. My question is very similar to Representative Hansen's. And I've seen in some life cycle analysis of ethanol production, there's an inclusion of the manufacture and transport of fertilizer used in raising the corn. And I'm wondering if in the life cycle analysis for oil, we also include the production of munitions for war, the airplane flights to bring troops to places where we're fighting, where we wouldn't probably be fighting if there weren't oil. If we were opposed to dictators generally, we would be fighting in Sudan. But we don't happen to be fighting there. We happen to be fighting somewhere else. And so my question is, with regard to including externalities, if we're going to include externalities like fertilizer in corn production, are we including externalities like weapons manufacture or petroleum?
Ms. Gupta.
Mr. Chair, I am not sure how they deal with those level of socioeconomic externalities associated with it. It is a low-carbon fuel standard, so it tends to focus on purely the carbon emissions associated with that. So that's a level that I think when the University of Minnesota people are here and how we develop a Minnesota-based framework for a low-carbon fuel standard, that might be a question to pose to them on how to structure their study, if that's something of concern.
Representative Portman.
I think there was probably a lot of carbon emitted when the wells were on fire in Kuwait, and at various times when the wells have been on fire in Iraq, and so I think it is definitely a carbon intensity question.
And Representative Clark.
Anyway, my question was, you had mentioned something about the distributional effects and the equity issues that you related to that. Could you elaborate a little bit more on that?
You know, I know that's an issue that the California Air Resources Board has identified as something to look further into. I'm not sure exactly what the equity impacts are. I know there might be some issues with the trading aspects if the low carbon fuel standard is established, but it could be something, again, that the university studies here, if we're concerned about that here in Minnesota, could look at as well. So I know they have identified it as an issue in California.
And Representative Breinhardt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking at the legislation itself and the compliance schedule. It's indicated as something that is to be achieved by a certain date, and then lists a wide range of strategies that might be enlisted in achieving that schedule. And as I read this and have listened to the testimony and thought about it, it seems to me the whole idea of a compliance schedule is a very fluid concept. The interplay between some of the mechanisms listed here and market factors and legislative action is obviously fluid in itself. So I'm having trouble envisioning something like a compliance schedule coming together in any crystallized way that isn't constantly in flux. So I'm wondering about the dynamic between those who are putting together something called a compliance schedule and all these other factors, and how you keep that conversation open and fluid and yet constructively moving forward to the target.
Mr. Chair, in regards to that legislation, I would let Representative Moe or Senator Stern speak to the specifics of that, but I know in terms of that issue of uncertainty and fluidity over time, the way that the regulatory body in California is dealing with that is that they have review periods every 5 years, or every 2 years. I believe it's every 5 years, where they do go back and revisit what were the assumptions based on the regulation development. And so they have put that into their compliance mechanism to go back and review based on best science available.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, and this is not at all a criticism. I'm trying to envision the process as it would move forward constructively. It mm-hmm. just seems to me to have a high level of complexity in terms of where the communication dynamic could be between policymakers and market forces, and how that conversation takes place, because you're using there, in some sense, there's a market-based aspect to it, but you're talking about using other types of mechanisms, like mandates, fines, cap and trade, you know. So there's a complex dynamic, and I'm just having trouble envisioning how that'll move forward.
Representative Moe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Breinert gets to the crux of the challenge for us as we move forward as to why we're not doing a bill hearing, but we're doing an informational hearing. When we were Senator Scherer and I were talking about this originally, we realized that there were significant unanswered questions. Thus, the study at the University of Minnesota, which we'll hear about, will help us to kind of to chart a path to how we actually get these questions answered, hopefully by next session, so we can do that. I think just conceiving of what's the mechanism for compliance is challenging. I think that does exist. California is getting pretty close, but we're going to want to have a Minnesota system, and we're not quite there yet. So, Ms. Gupta, as part of this, we've talked about this. It's, and you mentioned it briefly in your presentation, it's the piping, the refining, that might be part of the solution. We're not just talking about going to biofuels as the answer, but in the whole mechanism of delivery of fuel. We have an opportunity to reduce the carbon output. Maybe you could speak to that a little bit, and I think we're going to have some testifiers on that as well.
Yes, exactly. There's multiple levels of compliance, and one is to improve refinery efficiencies, the distance from which we get our fuel and transport it, and as well as electricity and hydrogen, compressed natural gas. So I believe it's not a matter of just going alternative in terms of other liquid fuels. The idea is to really spur innovation as well, so to make our current delivery system as efficient as possible, and then working beyond that to try and promote innovative new fuels that aren't necessarily biofuels. So.
Thank you. Any other questions? Okay, seeing none, we have next on the list to testify, thank you, Ms. Gupta, and we have Ms. Diane Schmidt and Ms. Jay Reinhart. And I thought I'd mention to the committee members that the presentation that was given by Ms. Gupta is not in your folders, but we can send one out to you via email afterwards.
So that will be forthcoming. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Diane Smith. I'm Director of Public Affairs for Flint Hills Resources. And also today with me is Jay Reinhart, who is Director of Operations for the company. And I want to just go through a few remarks, and then I would like to have Mr. Reinhart be available for some questions. He just got back from an intensive meeting in California where he was meeting a variety of the leaders in California on this issue, and I think he's got some interesting information that he can share, or at least present to you in terms of answers to questions. First of all, from Flint Hill's perspective, we agree that extensive studies is going to be required to make a system of low-carbon fuel standards operational in the state of Minnesota. So we not only embrace the idea of having a study, but we've actually reached out to the University of Minnesota and are in discussions with them right now about talking about the need to look into the future. So we're certainly being proactive in this regard. While California is currently looking at how to structure a low-carbon fuel standard, the final standard has not been proposed, let alone adopted, and I think that's important to understand. We're still dealing with a whole lot of questions in California. Currently, California is struggling with a number of issues, including the impacts on the source of crudes that are utilized, the land use impacts from increased biofuels, and the fact that there has been some study about biofuels actually increasing overall greenhouse gas emission standards relative to gasoline and diesel fuel. Some other issues that will have to be reviewed and looked at in any impact study on low-carbon fuel standards is the food supply, water supply issue, impact on emissions such as nitrogen oxides, VOCs, volatile organic compounds, technical feasibility, and time frame for implementation, and, of course, the cost to consumers throughout the whole process. As I mentioned, representatives from Flint Hills, including Jay, have met in the last couple of weeks at a meeting with the California Air Resources Board officials to discuss their work and look at how they are developing their low-carbon fuel standards. A tremendous amount of scientific research is underway, and numerous complex issues have been identified. We are suggesting, and I think we've brought to the attention this morning, the author, was that before adopting a study, we think it would be very helpful for the legislature or some body to get together and bring in some of these experts so we can actually have an intensive discussion with the experts that are working around the country. I think there's a lot of information to share and a lot of information that we're going to need before we would proceed in any comprehensive manner in the state of Minnesota. One of the issues that I think will come up in any study, and I think was alluded to here today, is potential for discouraging certain types of crude types. As many of you know, Canadian crude is the main source of crude oil for the state of Minnesota. We run almost exclusively Canadian crude in the state of Minnesota, and it's extremely important for our positioning, and it's important for the cost to consumers. As we look at any life cycle analysis or look at that particular fuel, it's going to be extremely important that we look at the cost-benefit analysis and what it's going to mean, because our alternative is to get Middle Eastern crude. And as you've seen and heard in testimony or discussion at the committee here today, there are all kinds of concerns with Middle Eastern crude as well. So I think as we go through this analysis, it's going to be extremely important that we look at that and how any type of study might impact the viability of our state resource and the fact that we do have two refineries in the state. I think it's also important as we're looking at the source of crude oil that we could have some perverse economic and global climate change emissions impacts as a result of how we deal with this. Disrupting or discouraging crude oil supplies from Canada could have a negative regional economic impact. It could also change the international markets and where the different fuel would go. For example, that Canadian crude is going to get developed. And if it goes to Canada, where we don't, or excuse me, if it goes to China from Canada, not only are you going to have some additional transportation costs and impacts from a carbon standpoint, but depending upon the types of policies that are implemented in China and the type of environmental impact, you can have very perverse impacts. And the fact that you're actually taking this crude and sending it over to be refined in a way which is a lot more harmful to the international air than the standards we have in place in the United States, where we have stricter standards for purposes of pollution control. Um, you're also going to be, I think, studying and needing to look at Canada's approach to how they're dealing with their Canadian crude supply. And I think we are suggesting that the Canadian government needs to take a very central role in looking at their own greenhouse gas emission standards as it relates to their fuel, how they get that particular Canadian crude out of the ground, and how it's refined or pre-refined before it comes here. I think it's also important, before I hand it over for questions, that we, as we look at this study, that we look at an overall impact of all of the biofuels. And we need to understand what are the various pushes and pulls with various emissions on whatever we're using, whether it's ethanol, biodiesel, if it's new cellulosic, if it's looking at traditional crude supply. I think we need to look at that, because if we're really trying to figure out what the next generation of fuels is going to be, and to do it in the most carbon-friendly way, we've got to look at not only carbon, but we've also got to look at the other various environmental factors like NOx, VOCs, other things that are regulated by the federal government as well as the state. So with that, I think that the main point we wanted to make today is that we're here to help. We are very interested in this study. We think that it's an important study to do, but I don't think that we have the answers right now, and I'm glad that the legislature is taking this interim step to get both some public and private money out into the marketplace to actually do some analysis before we march into this and disrupt any of the existing industries that we have in the biofuels area or any existing industries in the refining area. And with that, I don't know if Dave, you'd like to make a few comments.
Again, I'm Jay Reinhart, Director of Operations at Springfield Resources. Again, I guess a couple of key points that I would make is this is an extremely complex issue. Land use, land change use, understanding all these other impacts, and ultimately really truly an understanding the impact to the consumer on the price of fuel to the consumer. These are very complex issues. I think a study, better understanding these issues is a real important step. And one final point is that as you begin to understand this, you need to make sure these prevention plans don't create other things that could be either harmful to the environment or to our economy. Canadian crude is a great solution to foreign independence of what we have, and there's a lot of crude up there for us to have. And so trying to understand that and put that together is a real complex issue. And so really moving forward with study is a great solution.
And are there any questions for the testifiers? Representative Knuth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For Ms. Schmidt, I heard again and again, studies are great, and it's very complex, we need to study it. But I think you made a pretty strong statement in your testimony, and I'm just curious about what your assumptions behind it are in terms of the Canadian crude will get developed. I'm curious about how fast you think it will be developed, what your assumptions are to it being developed, if we took Representative Portman's ideas about looking at the weapons industry and fighting over oil in the Middle East, how we bringing that into a low-carbon fuel standard might actually make the Canadian crude more attractive. But I'm just curious about what your assumptions are in terms of all of that, all the oil sands being produced.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm going to let Mr. Reinhart answer that. He's actually spent a lot of time in Canada, and this is a part of his particular duties.
Mr. Reinhart.
Again, Jay Reinhart with Flux Hills. If you go up into Canada, there's billions of dollars being spent producing oil sands crude, Canadian crude, with the ultimate goal really bringing it initially. First of all, it's historically been run here in the Midwest over the last 50 years. Ultimately, what they're trying to do is even go beyond the Midwest, below, but even getting into the Gulf Coast part of the United States. And so there are currently multiple projects to bring hundreds of thousands of barrels of Canadian crude on per day, not only being constructed currently today, and over the last 5 years, significant growth has occurred, but also significant plans over the next 5 to 20 years to bring that on. And if you think about some of the comments around foreign independence and the other thing, this is actually a core solution to any type of energy independence that we want to drive, not only from a Midwest perspective, but actually from a national perspective.
Thank you. And as far as I think Representative Knut brings up a good point, as far as the low-carbon fuel standard possibly making Canadian crude more attractive and more profitable, isn't it possible that it could actually help when you're taking consideration all costs? Because you're not going to be transitioning immediately to these alternative fuels and alternative energy sources. There's going to be a long transition period where crude is still going to be used. So wouldn't it actually be helpful in steering our efforts towards acquiring crude that's less costly, less destructive to the environment and to other things?
Mr. Chair, just I agree with that. One other concept that I would tell you, I think that is ultimately there. If you look at the demand for energy in the world today, you know, the $110 crude or $111 crude that we currently have, this crude is going to be produced. And actually, if you look at Canadian crude actually coming for sure into Minnesota, but even the Midwest, even the Gulf Coast, it's probably the most environmentally sound place to bring it, because if it is not allowed to come here, it will actually go to China, and that will do one of two things. One, and this was actually covered in while I was out in California a couple weeks ago, they actually call it the crude shuffle, where if oil sands is not allowed to stay in its freight logical location, it actually increases greenhouse gas by pushing it to other areas, not only from a transportation perspective, increasing the greenhouse gas, but ultimately, as you take to other foreign countries that don't have the environmental standards that we have here in the United States and in the state of Minnesota, you're actually increasing the greenhouse gas emissions within the world by doing that. So there's multiple reasons that that this makes sense from an economic and from an environmental standpoint.
Mr. Reinhart, Representative Welty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Ms. Schmidt or Mr. Reinhart, you were talking about the fact that, you know, we're going to be competing with China with the resources, and I know there's growing competition for the energy resources, and in the district I represent, energy is definitely becoming a number one issue, and people continue to talk about, you know, what are we going to be able to do to lower our fuel prices that we pay at the pump. And so my first question is just the overall energy question. Right now, do you know with the Canadian oil sands or just with the Canadian crude that is being shipped down here by pipeline, what percentage is currently coming into the United States and what percentage is going to China?
Mr. Chair and Representative, currently, and I don't have the actual figures, but I would say it's well in excess of probably, besides Canadian home use, or take that away, that's in the Canadian uses crude to refine, but I would say at least a greater than 90% comes into the United States. There is some capability to go offshore currently, and it's rather limited across the current transportation system they have. The proposal that they have, though, is the actual one of building a very large line, pipeline up the West Coast across some environmentally sensitive lands. And so, ultimately, right now, we currently get about probably over 90%, and that's based off historical, and that's not off data, but that's probably about right.
Mr. Jarvis, we can actually look into that and try to find out more specific answer to that question as well.
Thanks. And Representative Welty, a follow-up.
And then just one follow-up question. You were talking about the standards that we have here in the United States, and that if this oil were to go to China, that, of course, we're going to have higher carbon emissions because they don't have the standards that we have here in the United States. But I look at it as simple economics, and as China continues to grow and they have the resources, they will get oil from wherever they need to. And if that's going to start being in competition with our main source of crude oil, here in the Midwest, I can only see in the horizon that we're going to continue to have higher fuel prices unless we get our crude from some other source. But let's say China continues to have the resources, they increase the competition, they start draining some of that crude oil from Canada. You weren't implying that in the future we'll be refining some of that resource here in the United States and then exporting that to China. That currently doesn't happen. When you export, when you sell,
you only sell that crude product, and then they'll refine it in that area. I just want to clarify that.
Mr. Chair, I want to just explain why we've talked about a Canadian crude and one of the reasons it has importance for this study. There has been a lot of discussion about looking at life cycle analysis of inputs. And if you look at Canadian crude, which could potentially have some life cycle impacts, and a decision is made in Minnesota or the United States that Canadian crude is not the product that we want to be favoring, that's when you're going to get these perverse economic impacts that are going to China. So I want to explain why this is so complicated, that as we're going through the study, we think it's important that you look at not only the individual carbon content of a variety of factors, but you have to look at what the impact is going to be and look at the overall global picture of it. And that's why we're bringing this up, which is that right now, Minnesota and the United States have a tremendous advantage in the fact that we are able to import and utilize Canadian crude. If any government policies are put into place that make it very difficult to use that, it could have some of these both economic and environmental consequences. And we think that's part of the discussion that needs to be looked at, and that's why we've been bringing this up.
Thank you, Ms. Schmidt. I think you bring up some legitimate concerns about the unintended consequences that we need to consider in this process as well. Representative Moe, you got a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I recognize that you're the chairman. I'm going to make a quick question then ask that maybe we get on to a couple other testifiers, and then so we can finish up with the testimony of the study that's going on will help us to kind of set a track for answering some of these questions. Specific to the tar sands in Alberta and Canadian crude in general, I guess I'd like to make the point that as we look at the life cycle of this source of energy, as you're alluding to, there are some carbon costs and perhaps other pollution costs to this source of energy that are different or in some ways more so than other sources of crude you might get here in the United States and other places because of the extraction process and the pumping process through the pipeline that comes through my district and down to here. There's some cost there that we're going to have to look at. So if we're actually concerned in the United States about our overall carbon output, in particular here in Minnesota, those costs will be in our calculation. Mm-hmm. And I would assume that you would agree with that. Mm-hmm. And that may or may not cause some of this to go to other sources, but here in Minnesota, we're deciding to reduce the amount of carbon output we have from the fuels we consume. And so that might affect the competitiveness of this source of energy, correct?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and I think that that's a big cornerstone of the debate, which is that we want to make sure that as you're making a public policy around carbon, that you're also understanding what the alternative outcome could be, and that there's a conscious public policy decision and an understanding about what the additional consumer costs could be if those decisions are made. And so I think it's clearly a public policy discussion that you have to have and decision you have to make, but there's a push-pull associated with it that we just need to make sure that we bring to your attention.
Thank you. And we do have to relinquish the room at 10 o'clock, so we have two more questions, and we'll move on to the other testifiers. Representative Hansen has a question.
Thank you, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll be quick. Does Flint Hills also produce fertilizer?
Flint Hills Resources does not produce fertilizer.
So is there any anhydrous production involved in the refining process at all? Anhydrous ammonia production at all?
Not in our refining process, no.
Thank you. And we have Representative Hilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if I can do this in any very succinct manner, but one of the things that I wanted to mention is my understanding is that, first of all, members should be aware that our number one source of imported crude is Canada, the entire United States. We talk a lot about Middle Eastern oil, but actually the biggest source of imported oil in the United States is Canada, followed by Mexico, and has been Venezuela third. I think Saudi Arabia is actually generally the fourth largest source of imported oil. So the development of tar sands in Canada currently is not very far along. I think I don't want to throw around figures that I don't have in front of me, but it's a relatively small amount. I think it's something like 1.5 billion or a million barrels a day. Is that correct, Mr. Reinhardt?
Yes, and might be a little bit higher. It's growing every day.
Right. The thing that's being alluded to here by the testifiers, I think, is the question of energy in versus energy out. Typically, petroleum production in the Middle East has had about a 100-to-1 ratio, which only takes about one unit of energy to extract or produce 100 units, one barrel in, 100 barrels out, basically. I think the ratio for producing oil from tar sands is about 1-to-3. That's more or less right.
I don't know about the foreign piece. I'm not quite sure. I don't tie to the 100-to-1, but it does take some energy to produce oil sands. That's correct.
And that energy comes from natural gas, a resource which in North America has peaked probably 5 or 6 years ago. So carbon footprints notwithstanding, I think we're looking at a situation in which we have a declining resource that's going to get much more expensive, both because of the cost of natural gas and because of the low energy in versus energy out ratio. Is that anything you disagree with,
Mr. Reinhardt?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I think that we're following your logic. I think that, that clearly we understand that throughout this process there's going to be a lot of discussion about energy in and energy out and looking at the overall resource. I think one of the reasons things like the study on low carbon fuel standards being looked at is what are some of the alternatives that are going to be out there. And I think that in clearly in the near term we're going to have crude oil is still going to be a stable source of energy, but I agree with in many of your committee hearings, I understand the points that, that have been brought up about looking you know, at energy and overall energy supplies in the future. So yes, I mean, I think that discussion should be incorporated in into this as well.
Thank you. And next we'll be move on to for the testimony from Mr. Lee. From the Chippewa Valley Ethanol Company. We're running low on time. If we could keep the comments under 5 minutes, that would be great.
Committee members, thank you for having me. My name is Bill Lee. I manage an ethanol plant that's in Minnesota, and I'm here to talk about what a low-carbon fuel standard could mean to Minnesota ethanol. Good news, it's a PowerPoint presentation of only 7 slides, and much of my thunder has been stolen, so I'm going to try to move through quickly. Why do a low-carbon fuel standard in Minnesota, or if I consider policy like this, I think it could complement other steps that are probably being taken to help the state meet its goals in terms of reducing greenhouse gas emissions. Those other states could be reducing vehicle miles traveled or increasing mileage per fuel efficiency. I think there's something that's missed also, that there's a potential to develop a new industry in Minnesota, a biomass industry. That industry is taking shape right now as we speak, and it's very much an emerging phase, but the potential to pay Minnesota produces for energy as opposed to folks in other states is very significant. And finally, I think this could provide an incentive to help Minnesota's existing corn ethanol industry transition and evolve into a more sustainable format and be complementary of a more broader emerging cellulosic biofuels industry. Minnesota's got a great base to build off. We have 750 million gallons of production. We've implemented the E10 back in 1998. We've got the largest E85 infrastructure in the country. We've got probably greener electricity than most states. I think Mike Bulls made the statement. I believe Minnesota probably has the lowest carbon fuel in the country right now. I've not seen a study, but I'd challenge another state to say, no, we have a lower carbon mix than Minnesota, at least in terms of the biofuel component. I can't speak to the hydrocarbon component. We're getting better. Minnesota's this legislature 3 years ago said we're going to move to E20. There's a federal waiver attempt right now, as we speak, that's being worked on to make that a federally sanctioned fuel. Our plants are getting greener, and we have, as I mentioned, a biomass industry that is starting to develop. I call Minnesota the home of low-carbon ethanol. There's three projects in particular that are worth noting. I think Mike Bull also mentioned these. The Corn Plus plant is using biomass fluid bed combustion to displace part of its natural gas and some windmills that are going to replace some of their coal-based electricity. Central Minnesota Ethanol Plant in Little Falls has a biomass gasifier, and they are working on another project to actually do cellulosic biofuel there in Little Falls. And we just started up our biomass gasifier last week in Benson, and we're working with wood right now, but we want to move into corn cobs as a biomass source. Just another point there that's something often missed in the debate. Plants like ours that convert to biomass power for thermal energy can improve their greenhouse gas performance from 20% better than baseline to 50% better than baseline. And that's a pretty significant thing that can be done fairly quickly. I'm not necessarily speaking for every ethanol producer in the state. I guess I'm speaking for the small group that's out here in front of the biomass and lower carbon in that vanguard, but I believe this is probably good for our industry here in the state. We can create an incentive, a market-based and performance-based incentive to move away from from fossil inputs and also move to more sustainable agronomy practice for our corn. It would allow our plant to capture about $12 million we're spending every year on natural gas. That's money that's going out of the state. We can capture that in our plant either through savings to our plant operations or payments to our own co-op members for biomass ag materials that they might be producing. If you multiply $12 million a year times 15 plants in the state, that's about $180 million a year net back to the state that's flowing out right now. And I believe you have to look no further than today's headlines to see that our industry might benefit from addressing the positive in a positive way our environmental attributes. Despite the headlines, biofuels are not inherently worse than petroleum. It's like any other technology. It's neither inherently good or bad. It's how you do it that matters. And the studies that have been out there have projected worst-case scenarios on land use and gone very far afield in terms of ascribing indirect impacts to corn ethanol. The facts are we're now exporting more corn out of Minnesota than we were 12 years ago when we started our plant. We actually had our two highest corn export years in the whole country the last 2 years. It is not biofuels production that is changing land use policy in other countries. And what's happened is we have been able to grow a biofuels industry here in Minnesota and in the United States based on the increased productivity of corn. And these studies generally discount the impact of improved yields, and they completely discount more advanced agronomy strategies such as use of cover crops for sequestering carbon, progressive ag residue recovery systems like we're working on right now with corn cobs. And the fact is agriculture has the ability to grow and through innovation to grow in terms of its productivity and its sustainability. I would say that in contrast to that, petroleum and fossil energy sources have much more limited ability to improve their carbon footprint.
20%, this is a fact I heard, 20% of natural gas in Canada is going to tar sands. I appreciate the environmental concern that the folks from Plymouth Hills have about how we're making biofuels, but, you know, there's a serious land use change going on in Alberta right now. And, you know, one thing we get beat up a lot on is it takes a lot of water to make ethanol. Well, it takes a lot of water to make the steam that you have to use to thaw out the permafrost, too. So I think the low carbon fuel standard is potentially a very good program for this state and for the country. The devil's going to be in the details, because how far do you look at direct impacts? How do you construct a model that is manageable and that we have an agreement makes sense, the boundaries of the model? And if you want to go far afield in one area, biofuels, but you really don't want to look very far afield at the indirect impacts on the petroleum side, that's probably not a workable model. So I don't pretend to have the answers to how that model might be created. I'm just saying that our industry is ready to be a positive part of this future, and we would encourage this body to move forward in this direction.
Thank you very much, Mr. Lee. Any questions for Mr. Lee? Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Mr. Lee. You're definitely, I think, an ethanol plant manager that has evolved your plant's operation and over time and made some good decisions. I don't know if you touched on it, what else you do at your plant, but the vodka production, the organic alcohol for the phase for Aveda, and a biomass gasifier, the DDGs, and, you know, choosing not to expand, double your capacity this past couple years. So I think you've seen how you need to evolve, and we've talked at length about the public relations war that's going on against corn ethanol. And I guess I'm just wondering, in your testimony about low carbon fuel, good for Minnesota, good for Minnesota ethanol, that it enhances positive environmental attributes, which low carbon fuel is being driven out of, it seems like, California, emerging out of California. And we've got another pending piece of legislation, clean cars. I'm wondering, first my opinion. My opinion is that the current coalition between the corn growers, the Farm Bureau, the Farmers Union, and the auto dealers, auto manufacturers, and such, is one that does not enhance the positive environmental attributes of ethanol in Minnesota. The current, I guess, relationship with the people that were against ethanol 10, 12, 15 years ago in the first place seem to now be discussing, oh, we'd really like to use more ethanol, and this California clean cars isn't good enough for the promotion of ethanol. I'm just wondering how you think that the corn growers, American Coalition of Ethanol, Farm Bureau, Farmers Union, being married to the auto folks right now, helps or hurt the positive environmental attributes of corn ethanol in Minnesota.
Mr. Chairman, please. Representative Peterson, thank you for a great question. I will agree with one thing I think everyone said. These are complex issues. I've been lobbied heavily the last month to weigh in and support a California clean car standards. I think that's a little far afield from the low car. I think it's somewhat a separate issue from the low carbon fuel standard, quite frankly. And I struggle to understand that issue and try to delve in and get to the facts. It's a very complicated issue. But the clean car standards, that really gets into is that the right approach to move vehicle technology in a direction that's good for this state? And I have had to conclude that it's not clear that that's the right approach. I understand there's a lot of good-intended people who want to see that happen, and there's some good attributes that could things that could come out of that, but it's been difficult to see that approach fit really well with what we're doing in Minnesota. Quite frankly, I think a case could be made that Minnesota has provided far more leadership in climate than any state. And the fact that you're sitting here looking at this and saying, should we adopt, work toward a low carbon fuel standard is further demonstration of that. California has been at the vanguard of a lot of progressive environmental policy. They have also had a strong antipathy to biofuels, and it's beyond the time we have for me to try to say why I think that is. But there's not been ethanol's best friend in a lot of ways, and even as we work on a low carbon fuel standard, there are folks who want to construct the rules so it'll be positive for one industry and negative for another. And I think that's the real challenge we're going to have. How do we get some agreement on the rules of how do you construct a model like the GREET model from Argonne Labs? How do you construct a model that's meaningful, relevant, and yet not so cumbersome that you can't work it? So we have bedfellows at times, you know.
And I thought I'd mention at this point, I was just informed that we will be able to keep the room for longer, so we can continue on with the discussion. And Representative Junkie, you had a question?
Not to Mr. Lee, but just to members and audience, Representative Peterson forgot to mention, if you want to support Minnesota agriculture, buy Shakers Vodka is the brand you're looking for. Shakers.
Okay. Next, the Representative Cornish had a question.
Real quickly, you know, it's easy to beat up on ethanol, but you just dream if you think you can solve the problem by getting rid of ethanol with these other fuels, because now we're talking about harvesting our natural resources to make fuel up north. We're going to run into a problem with the loggers, competing with them, driving the prices up. We've been working for years for wildlife. You can't even make a cut in northern Minnesota anymore in any forestry without getting okayed by wildlife. Now we're talking about converting our wood for fuel in disregard to the wildlife. We're talking about switchgrass in southern Minnesota. The grand plan by the enviros down there was to take all the county roads and township roads, turn them into switchgrass. The last nesting habitat we have for pheasants and birds, they want to turn into switchgrass for producing fuel. And if you think you're going to get by without using some type of chemicals or fertilizer or different type of harvesting techniques or land use, I think we're dreaming. That's why this is such a complex subject. And here we got a state like California, and especially policy coming out of Berkeley, they lead the nation in a lot of ways that I don't want Minnesota to. They got different topography, they got different land use, they got different land ownership, a different climate, and we're trying to model rules after them. So that's why some of our members, you know, give them a hard time about, yeah, you just want to study, you don't want to take any action. That's the reason, the complex issues, the wildlife, the nesting habitats, the resources that we need to study.
Well, and I think that the low carbon fuel standards that we're looking at here would be developed for and tailored to Minnesota. It wouldn't be following any other states, but certainly looking at what other states do so that we can learn from them. Let's see, Senator Anderson was next on the list.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I'm not sure if I have a question, more of a comment, and I just want to first comment that, you know, as a metropolitan area legislator, listening to what Representative Peterson said, everywhere I go, I hear criticism of ethanol. It's a real public outcry in the metropolitan area. And I'm a metropolitan area legislator that's always defended biofuels and defended ethanol and voted for it year after year after year. But I think it is important that we don't ignore that public outcry, that instead we try to respond to it. And I think Mr. Lee is a great example of the leadership that we have in the state. I just want to applaud you for what you're doing, and I've been to your plant and I've tasted your vodka, really good. Great work that you're doing. And I think that in order to keep Minnesota moving forward in the same direction as, you know, as one state, and to maintain that support for people, from people all across the state for biofuels, we have to be very serious about saying that as the elected officials for this state, we are going to help lead the way, and we're going to support progressive ethanol producers and farmers and others who are trying to reduce the carbon impact of the fuels and to go even beyond, where we are now. And there's real progress being made, and that's that's what I tell my constituents and what I tell people across the metropolitan area when I talk to them about this, that we can have biofuels and we can do it in a way that helps us meet carbon reduction goals, and it's really good for the environment. People are skeptics about that, and we have to really we have to win that public opinion, because I firmly believe that having more biofuels is the answer that we are going to have in the future as part of our carbon reduction strategy. And, you know, we've had a lot of debate about cap and trade this year, and we know whatever happens this year or next year is unknown, but the fact is we're headed inevitably as a nation to carbon restrictions. It's just inevitable, and every presidential candidate says that, and we know it's coming. And so if we can help, I think Mr. Lee is absolutely right that if we can have ethanol producers, farmers, and others, you know, loggers who can understand how to get ahead of that curve, we will bring so much benefit and add so much value to our economy here by, you know, we're going to be the ones exporting our ethanol in the future to places like California and all across the country where they're passing laws right now to reduce carbon content. So, you know, I think we do need to be careful about how we do it and study the implications of it. I think that's a good place to start. But this is the direction we have to go. So I just wanted to make that comment.
Okay. And Representative Schumper is next.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator, I guess I have to honestly say I'm going in just the opposite direction you are and becoming increasingly more skeptical about the commitment of the state to ethanol and biofuels. And to be real succinct, I think in developing this lower carbon fuel standard, the biggest problem I see, and it was reflected by the people who testified from Flintfield, is that we are not taking into account the secondary environmental impact of biofuel development. I mean, that's essentially what we're hearing from, is high food prices, changing in land use patterns, changes all over the world. And that's my concern, and why I'm increasingly skeptical about it. Sure, you can retrofit some plants to make them more energy efficient in all kinds of good ways, and I commend you for that. But the bigger global picture, I don't see biofuels coming up with the solution. I think the solution is in conservation and energy efficiency right now, primarily. Though I think, as the Europeans are doing, and I'm sure you know this, Senator, the Europeans are requiring that biofuels be certified, that they actually, in their development, are reducing greenhouse or carbon emissions. So, you know, I'm going to be very skeptical, to be honest.
Well, and Trumper, I think that obviously conservation and other efforts are important, but I also think biofuels need to be part of the mix, and certainly there are numerous environmental benefits as well as economic benefits for our state to pursuing that as well. Nobody is claiming that there's any one solution to the problem here, but there are multiple ones. And Senator Anderson,
no,
you wanted
to follow up? I was going to say the same thing. We need them all. We need all of these strategies to reduce the carbon to the extent that has to be done to turn things around for our planet, so our children will live in a world that that still allows the possibility of a quality of life for all of us. We're going to need all these strategies, but I completely agree with you that we have a lot of issues to grapple with to make sure we're doing biofuels the right way. And, you know, we can be for biofuels, but be for better ways of doing it than we're doing now. And that's, you know, I don't think we disagree about that.
And I think that these standards like these will push us in that direction. So, and Mr. Lee, you want to
respond? Mr. Chairman, if I may respond, committee members. There is a backlash against biofuels. And, you know, 12 years ago when Chippewa Valley Ethanol started, corn ethanol was sort of a Midwestern curiosity. It was sort of a old friend thing. And through the actions really of this body in really creating a Minnesota industry, and catalyzing the growth of corn ethanol throughout the Midwest and points beyond, we have now become an 8 billion gallon a year industry. One of the consequences of that level of growth is we're big enough to take seriously as a threat. And we are a challenge to a number of incumbent industries. not the least of which is the petroleum industry. We also have folks in the food industry who are not our fans right now, folks in the livestock industry who are not our fans, people who have for decades benefited on a cheap food policy, and now the land needs to provide food and fuel and to be broad societal benefits. And they don't like that. And there are considerable dollars being spent by these incumbent industries to create a lot of media to focus on water use, food versus fuel, as highlight the negatives of biofuels, and so we don't have to talk about some other issues. We have undeniably a run-up in a lot of different commodities, and biofuels is typically at the top of the list of why that is, but there are a lot of other factors. A weak dollar policy makes our grain great buy. We've got huge global demand, seems to be unrelenting all around the country, all around the world. We've had some crop failures, notably wheat failures in Australia. And there seems to be, we have a cereal bubble economy here. We had a dot-com economy bubble, then we had a mortgage housing bubble, and now people are chasing money in commodity markets. This is the place to put money. What's missed sometimes in this, without the possibility of the biofuels industry, a lot of the crop genetics companies would not have had a motivation to find out how do we increase the yields in corn production that have been keeping us ahead, really, of even the consumption of biofuels. So we have been part of the reason that we are more productive as a food producer in this country than we were 10 or 15 years ago. I'm a member of Minnesota Corn Growers, and I'm also a member of National Resource Defense Council. And what I see missing in this debate is people wanting to come to a middle ground. We don't have a lot of time in this country to get to that middle ground and forget protecting sacred cows. Let's come to the middle ground and figure out realistic ways to address serious energy issues and climate change issues. And I'm hoping that this good body can be part of that middle ground.
Thank you. And we have two more people on the list to ask questions, but I understand Mr. Kelly has to leave soon. So, Representative Mull.
Mr. Chairman, I would ask if, with all due respect, to additional questions, we could maybe bring those back and allow the university to make their presentation on the study, and then maybe we could go back to questions for people who still had them.
That's fine with me. It's fine with the questioners. We can just come back to the question after Mr. Kelly makes their presentation. Okay, so thank you, and Mr. Leapy, and just come back after this testimony is completed. We have that. Welcome, Senator Kelly, and Mr. Warner.
Mr. Chairman and members, thank you for the opportunity to be here, and it's been fascinating to listen to the discussion. I'm Steve Kelly. I'm the director of the Center for Science, Technology, and Public Policy at the Humphrey Institute, part of the University of Minnesota. And a few months ago, back last October, I'd never heard of a low-carbon fuel standard, and have been learning a lot about it since then. Back in January, a few of us started to convene meetings among faculty members at the U and with the Isaac Walton League to talk about what kinds of things we ought to do to learn more about how a low-carbon fuel standard would apply to Minnesota, recognizing, as the conversation among the members has done, that Minnesota, unlike California, is a producer state, and it would be difficult to wholesale adopt the California approach. It would probably be inappropriate to do that, and that therefore we ought to understand better the issues that the legislature would face in analyzing a low-carbon fuel standard. And so we began working on this study and have identified a number of sources. My center has contributed Mr. Warner's time to this effort so far. The Initiative on Renewable Energy and the Environment has made a commitment of $25,000 to the study, and we are confident that we can raise the money from a variety of private sources, but we appreciate the fact that Senator Anderson is considering some funding for this, and there are a couple constraints here. We'd like to have the study done in time to be useful to the legislature in 2009. So there's a limit to how much you can do if that's your target time period. And then secondly, resources. And so we think it's reasonable to attain the resources that we could get spent in the time between now and your 2009 session. And so we're confident that we can do work that will answer some, maybe not all, of the questions that you have. Because there's still a lot of uncertainty out there, but our goal is to try to be as comprehensive as we can about the interaction of a low-carbon fuel standard with other policies, and to identify the impacts on sort of broad sectors of the Minnesota economy of adopting a low-carbon fuel standard. And we've identified the lead researcher for the program, Dr. Steve Taft, who is an applied economist. And so I think coming at it from an applied economics point of view will be the right angle to enable the legislature to have confidence in the sort of approach to the research. And since I still don't know very much about a low carbon fuel standard, I'm going to ask Mr. Warner, who has looked at the California program and has worked with Dr. Taft on planning the study, and so Mr. Warner can explain more about what we hope to do.
Mr. Warner, welcome. Thank you, Mr. Chair. There are three main goals for the proposed study. The first one is to develop an analytical framework from which to compare a low-carbon fuel standard to other state and federal interaction with state and federal policies. Also, to compare alternative formulations of the low-carbon fuel standard for the state of Minnesota. The reason for this is that it'll provide information in a clear and transparent manner for the state legislature. It also will model the policy synergies and conflicts with any existing policies that are in place or for the future. It'll basically help identify key decision points that would be needed for the formulation of this low-carbon fuel standard for the state, and to produce a viable design. The larger goal is to investigate the economic impacts of a low-carbon fuel standard for the state. This would be done by developing a mathematical model that would predict various future location of low-carbon fuel facilities, various crop use, and other feedstock developments in the future. We will also develop best estimates for inputs for future facilities and future inputs. The proposals that will be developed in part one as viable frameworks for the state will also be explored as part of this model. And basically, the goal of the economic impact is an accurate model of the transportation system and its effect on other systems such as the state's ecology and environment and other industries. The third main goal is the development of current life cycle assessment models. The existing models currently are missing more indirect effects of fuel inputs and certain market-mediated effects such as efficiencies of production capacity. So the first thing that we would do is select a model that would be appropriate for the state that would be in line with that could possibly be integrated with what models are being might be proposed at the future national level or other states. This would be specifically important because EPA is currently exploring what life cycle assessment models would be appropriate at a national level. We would try to add to the existing model as well as reduce the existing uncertainties in various model components.
And finally, we would calibrate this model for use in the state of Minnesota, taking into account current industry practices in the state, as well as current feedstock capacities in the state. This would be also to help design a certification program using the full fuel cycle analysis in the state of Minnesota.
And Mr. Chairman, the handout is a brief outline of the policy decisions related to a low-carbon fuel standard. I think the testimony you've heard and some of the comments from members have indicated that moving in the direction of being conscious about the carbon content of the fuel we use makes sense. If you stay at that high level, no problem, no controversy. But you start to put details under that, and it gets a lot more complicated. And we don't propose that the science can deal with all of the policy decisions that you'll have to make. But what we do see is that we can provide a broader range of reliable information so that you can make better choices about some of these decisions that could be incorporated in a low-carbon fuel standard. And the model that I can't remember whether it was Representative Hilty or someone else who brought up unintended consequences. When Mr. Warner and Dr. Taft talked about a model, what we're going to try to do is put together a systems dynamic model that tries to pay attention to feedback loops and a variety of other effects, so that we can at least try to call out some potential unintended consequences by paying attention to some of the things that often get overlooked in how these different policies cause feedbacks in other parts of the system. So we're trying to look at Minnesota fuel production and fuel refining as a system and see how the pieces are going to fit together with a low-carbon fuel standard.
And we have questions here. Representative Welty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to testify, you mentioned that your study, you want to incorporate the efficiencies of the process that we use here in Minnesota. And I'm just wondering, as you move forward and develop a plan, is your plan going to be ongoing in that new technologies that come about will be integrated, will be measured against the technologies that we're using currently? And I just want to bring this point to light. You know, I've been waiting in the biofuel industry for the gasification of biomass, and we finally have that coming online over the last year or two, and I know Mr. Lee's plant is up and going now, and so is that going to be measured? Is that technology going to be measured where you say in Minnesota, for instance, we have an ethanol plant that gasifies biomass and it's used in the process, and this has a lower carbon footprint than the current plant? I mean, are you going to look at that specific of information? Because I really believe in Minnesota we need to do that since we're a leader in that area.
Mr. Chairman, maybe Mr. Warner will correct me, but my sense, Mr. Chairman and Representative Welty, my sense is that as states choose which of these life cycle assessment models to use, that is where those kinds of issues will be reflected, so that technology change has to be recognized in the model. So much is going on. The recent announcement by POET that they're going to try to, that they've got a deal to use methane from a landfill as a fuel source for distilling ethanol. There's a lot going on. An executive at 3M told me about a membrane technology that might make it possible to separate ethanol without distillation, which would dramatically change the energy, potentially, assuming that all the other technological issues work out. So I think one of these issues will be the extent to which these life cycle models incorporate or recognize that technology change in the life cycle assessment.
Mr. Chair, I also want to add that technological change will also be incorporated into the economic impact model. So well, we won't be looking at specific technologies. We'll look at various rates of technological change to the model and incorporate sort of a sensitivity analysis of how technology might change in the state.
Okay. And Representative Junkie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just following up what Representative Welty said, I guess I just want to get your assurance. I'm sure it's there. Some of the more recent history at the U have seen some studies come out that maybe lacked in collaboration and input and review. And I just want assurance that you will be collaborating across a broad spectrum of your colleges and your resources, whether it's School of Engineering on some of these issues that you just brought up, the membrane technology and others, or whether it's College of Agriculture, Dr. Levine over there, on the agriculture side, so we take into account increased yields and conservation practices and other things that go on with farm inputs. I just want assurance that you're not going to be working in a vacuum on this, that you will be broadly bringing people together and ultimately having a broad review of your product before it shows up in the public.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Junkie, certainly on the academic side, we have involvement from people in the College of Biological Sciences, from Applied Economics, Dr. Sungwon Su, who is an expert on life cycle analyses and is in the College of Food, Agriculture, and Natural Resource Sciences. And then from the Humphrey Institute, Dr. Elizabeth Wilson, who has spent a lot of attention on the policy implications, the policy issues in managing fuel and energy in a carbon-constrained world. I think we're going to have a wide range of academic expertise, and then if there's a constructive role I play in this, it's to remind people whose questions they're going to have to answer at the end of the process. And so I think we're certainly going to be aimed to be grounded in the real challenges that this legislature has to face in making these decisions.
Okay. And Representative Moe, yes, question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just further on that same point, when we're looking at the life cycle inputs of energy, I'm just assuming that what we will get back from the university are policy decisions that we will need to make. At what point do we go back in the life cycle of energy production? Do we talk about national defense costs, or are we talking about the extraction costs, processing costs of tar sands up in Alberta? You know, at what point do we make those decisions, and then how do we kind of calculate that into the carbon content of the fuel that is then will be competing in the marketplace here in Minnesota, correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Moe, that's correct. We're not expecting to be able to eliminate conflict with respect to this issue. We are hoping that by doing the kind of solid research that the university folks are capable of doing, that we'll be able to narrow the range of conflict and assure that it's not the issues aren't being raised based on guesswork, but are being based on sound information.
Okay. And Representative Semper.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kelly, I hope when you're doing these models, you're also going to take into effect, and I didn't hear either of you mention it, some of the secondary environmental impacts, such as increased fertilizer runoff and increased pesticide use and bringing 15 million acres more into ethanol production and the impact on that on soil erosion. I would suggest that you could eliminate some controversy by not taking funding from the commodity groups and from the ethanol industry to fund this study. I know you mentioned earlier you were going to get private funding from this. I think there'd be a lot less skepticism about the results if you didn't have funding from those groups.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Representative Trumper, that's always good advice. And by having a range of contributors to the study, for example, the Initiative on Renewable Energy and the Environment gets money from Xcel Energy through this legislature's renewable energy research fund, and so they're funding a portion of the study, and I know Ms. Schmidt said that they have been talking with, and I know they've been talking with Dean Eldy about wanting to be connected to the study. So we're not picking and choosing in a sense of contributions. And if the legislature provides additional funding through the Next Gen Energy Board for this, that'll be great. Then there'll be less pressure on raising money from outside resources. The Agriculture and Utilization Research Institute is another group that's interested in understanding this better and potentially participating in the study. So we don't see any particular interest group having influence on the outcome. I think the folks, the academics who are going to conduct the study are the ones who are going to control the direction and not the funders. I'll make sure of that. With respect to your broader point about the other impacts, that I will express some uncertainty, and I'll go back and talk to Dr. Taff about it. I think that's the issue where the level of funding and the amount of time is an issue, because we could try to model those broader impacts in the same way that the Biobusiness Alliance of Minnesota Biofuel Study has tried to pay attention to broader impacts. I don't know if it'll be in the study that will be, portion of the study that will be ready at the beginning of the legislative session in 2009, but that's something we can go back and talk about. But we believe that the water quality and land use implications of this legislature's policy decisions are important.
Representative Welty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make one brief follow-up point to what former Senator Kelly was talking about and what Representative Shumper brought up. I know in committees that I served on where the universities have been present to talk about studies that they've done and funding that they've received, that they have very, very strict standards. And if there was ever any implication that a funding source or a funder had any influence over a study, it would undermine the research that the University of Minnesota does, and they in no way want that to ever occur. And so I know that point has been brought out, so I just want to make sure that it's not implied that sources of funding are in some way going to change the direction of what is going to be released from the study.
And I do not see any other questions. So thank you, Mr. Kelly and Mr. Warner.
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you for your time.
And Mr. Lee, if you want to come back to the table. And Representative Smith, now you had a question for Mr. Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this kind of goes back to your concluding comments and just if we all get our Soakers vodka comment in. I actually heard about it for the first time over in England from, I think it was your daughter.
Really?
Yeah, at a pub in Oxford. So it's a small world.
Indeed.
That was probably 3 years ago now. But
drinking shakers?
Not available there.
I don't think they were selling it, but I have it at home now. The question I had is just trying to get a sense of the ethanol industry, because you know, the people I represent are frankly part of the ethanol and biofuel backlash, and they're suburban people who read pretty extensively, and I setting up the framework, you know, thinking about the auto industry fighting improvements in fuel efficiency standards and now getting a backlash, frankly, not being able to sell cars as well in different markets and around the world. And I think I've always responded to my constituents, we need to be moving to the next generation of ethanol and biofuels, and that's where we need to go. We can't just, and we need to do it as quickly as possible, otherwise the backlash, I think, will stop the industry if it doesn't move fast enough to meet some of the concerns that are being put forth. And so I'm just trying to get a sense from you, since I don't have many ethanol producers or farmers in my district, what is the talk in terms of moving the industry forward? You're obviously a leader. I've heard that over and over again, and we've heard that mentioned here. So a sense from the ethanol biofuel industry seeing this backlash as a way to jumpstart into the next generation and more environmentally, economically friendly biofuels.
Mr. Lee.
You get what I'm trying to say?
I think so.
Okay.
Thank you,
Mr. Lee.
Chairman, Representative. I call it the Empire Strikes Back. I don't know what else to say. I mean, there, it's not a coincidence. There's so many studies negative on biofuels. And quite frankly, the rapid growth in the last 2 or 3 years is part of the reason. The Minnesota plants were growing at a fairly slow pace. You know, when our guys put money in our plant, it was a big leap of faith, and it was nothing proven, but they took some risks. They were pioneers, and they've had some pretty good years since then. At that time, back in the mid-90s, conventional investors wouldn't have touched an ethanol plant with a 11-foot pole. Suddenly, they got convinced it was the place to be, and everybody had to get into the industry at once. And so a lot of new money has come in, a lot of production capacity has come on, and it wasn't the original Minnesota plant overhyping biofuels and saying it is the answer, it's the solution. You know, clearly we have a little fun with our petroleum folks. They're not here. Sorry. They're one of our big customers. We're going to need petroleum. There's no, ethanol, biofuels are only going to be a part of a solution. But all we're saying is, as we go forward and construct a template to start to change the accounting system so that things that were outside the accounting system, like carbon emissions, are going to be part of that, we've got to look fairly and equitably. I don't think the ethanol industry is shy at all about saying we can compete on a carbon basis with petroleum or coal or anything if we have a fair accounting system. And the fact that there's a lot of money flowing into research and ads that want to focus on some of the shortcomings that we have, it's mostly a distraction, in my opinion, from looking at the much huger shortcomings that the alternatives have. And so I don't know how the state or the university is going to construct this model. You know, one thing that comes to mind is there's the most widely followed model in this country is the BCS poll in college football. Does everybody agree on that thing? I mean, you got computers figuring out who should be number one. There's horrible disagreement, and this is going to be like that. We're going to have to put something together. Nobody gets everything they want, but we're going to have some sort of model that we can use as a yardstick. And I think the U.S. ethanol industry, biofuels industry, is eager to move forward. I see this as a tool to help propel us in that direction. Right now, there's precious little incentive. There has been very little incentive for someone to choose biomass over natural gas over coal, quite frankly. I mean, it's tough to do coal, so that's a disincentive. But there's no pull. There's no pull in the right direction. And I think that's what I see the potential for that here with the low-carbon fuel standard, if it's done correctly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I've heard a couple times mentioned today around the table somehow the backlash on biofuels. And I guess to respond to that, I guess I would blame us as legislators and our industry, Mr. Lee and the ethanol folks, corn growers, Farmers Union, Farm Bureau. We're just not as good at promoting, I guess, than the other side is at this point in time. And we're not funding the studies on food versus fuel and water use and other things like the other side is at this time. But I think it's good, and we should start reminding people the positives of this biofuel industry. And unless we do it, no one else is going to step up. For example, reminding people that the reason this whole industry started was because of air tests at University and Snelling back in the mid-90s when we had testing stations in this state. And we were making a decision whether to go with MTBE or ethanol as an oxygenate to clean our air. We decided to go with ethanol and support that industry, and a co-op industry, farmer-owned industry, developed in this state because of that. And we no longer have testing stations in the Twin Cities. We were successful in what we did, and that's the first thing we need to remind our environmental community about is why this industry came about to begin with. And then we need to go down the list of items on why biofuels are important. Number one, and the fuel or the oil companies admitted this in testimony in Congress, I believe last week or 2 weeks ago, biofuels hold down
the price, overall price we pay for liquid transportation fuels. Some estimate as high as 15%, but the oil companies actually acquiesced in Congress at the hearings last week that it was at least 5%. That's their estimate, and they're the enemy. And they are saying, yes, it holds down the price because of the competition and the additives and the cost of those fuels. We've seen with our own Mankato State University in North Dakota actual realization in latest studies that mid-grades of ethanol and biofuels increase gas mileage. And that's going to be a whole new deal that our folks around the state and our metro friends will be excited about, using blender pumps and an E20 or E30 to actually increase your gas mileage. And we can go into the reasons why, but the study's available now, and I have read it and reviewed it. We are exporting ethanol from this state, so we are making money in this state. We're bringing money into our economy. We are exporting those fuels. Talking about the rural economy and Minnesota's economy, it's unbelievable what it's done for us out there. And without that, with that industry, this biofuels industry, which is now moving into our woodlands and other places too, it's a tremendous opportunity for this state and for folks that are involved with that. And certainly, you know, the food costs, we need to do a better job of that too. Let's remember that the United States overall, we pay about 7.2% of our dollar for food. That's less than any other country on the planet. Europe is 2 to 3 times higher. Vietnam pays 40%, for example, of their dollar towards food. So we still have cheap food. But yeah, it is a shock when eggs go from 75 cents to $1.50 for large eggs in the store, you know. But the other thing we haven't done is sort out what part of that increase in cost is due to feed costs, grain costs, and what part of it is due to $112 oil costs, which go into production, which go into transportation, and what part also is in wages, which we support the union and labor wages and benefits increasing. What part is actually wage increase and inflation, fuel increase and inflation, versus the portion that is directly related to the grain? So we can throw out things all day long on some kind of backlash on biofuels, but until we start educating people on why that industry is here and where it's going, and I agree with Mr. Lee and others, this is a transition industry. If we're going to make moving the next generation of fuels, which is probably cellulosic ethanol, that's going to be produced at the same plants that make corn ethanol now. We have the infrastructure in place. We have the rail lines there. We have the transportation infrastructure. That's where the next generation is going to go to. You can't just shut one down and develop another. And there always will be a need for liquid fuels, at least in my lifetime, that I can foresee. Even if we go to hydrogen or other sources, there will be a need for liquid fuels, and we're going to have to produce them somewhere. And right now, the alternatives are oil-based or biofuel-based. So I think it would behoove us to do a little education on our own part and not just pick and choose the little pieces that we think are fun to throw about, and maybe less listening to the press and more making our own views known would be very helpful at times. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Representative Cornish.
Real quickly, in answer to the representative's question about what are they doing, is everybody that does a reading on ethanol should balance it off with American Coalition for Ethanol magazine, Ethanol Today, and it is somewhat naturally biased towards the ethanol industry, but in there you'll see that they're pouring literally millions of dollars into research, and that the brine is trying to make their fermentation progress better, and they're working with Heiner Japan. They just got a big grant for research, and they're trying to use. They know that it behooves them, rather than get regulations forced on them like the auto industry or anybody else, to do it themselves and do it quickly, because they're really aware. You can read the article, you can sense the heat they're feeling from the community. Their public relations, governmental relations people are doing all they can to research and use less gas, less energy, electricity, produce more of their own. And so I think they are really trying to put a lot of their profits into research.
Representative Anderson, or Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think this is a good discussion to be having, even though it's not that easy to have it. I just want to just to tell my rural friends that the backlash is real, and it's not all funded by the petroleum industry. And I think if we suggest that all the criticism of ethanol are coming from the petroleum industry and it's a PR campaign, I think we're kind of missing the point. And certainly that's very true that there is, that's part of it. But I think when you have university studies pointing to, for example, the dangers of plowing up CRP land for more crop production, I think most of us would agree that that has negative environmental impact. And so I think it behooves us to take, separate the real issues from the PR campaign, because there are real issues. And I think the point is that if we just defend the status quo, we will lose support for these biofuels. And all of us, many of us, are under tremendous pressure from our constituents to stop ethanol. Literally, that's what people tell me when I go to district meetings. They say, stop it. Take the money away. Don't give them any more support. It's bad for us. And I agree with you, Representative Junkie, and others who have said, and Mr. Lee, that if we were digging for oil in Minnesota and people could really compare the impact side by side, we might get a more real reaction. Because I tell them, well, it sure as heck is a lot better than the alternative. And when I put E85 in my vehicle, I'm reducing emissions. But people are, they're not really comparing those apples to apples. I admit that. But they're also saying, we're seeing those impacts here in our state, and it concerns us. And we're seeing it, the impact for an industry that's grown really quickly. So I think, and Representative Junkie, I've been talking with your counterpart, Senator Vickerman, on the B-20 mandate bill that is moving forward, which will sort of move us quickly down the path of increasing biodiesel mandates. And I've talked to Senator Vickerman, and I've been really happy about that we've been able to negotiate some compromises that will put some sustainability concepts into place, and some cellulosic or non-conventional feedstock ideas into that. And I think we need to be cognizant that this is real, and that it is a political danger to those who really want to see ethanol move forward, that we have to grapple with, and we can't just dismiss it as a PR campaign. I think we need to take it seriously and incorporate sustainability concepts as we move forward, or we will not be able to have the political support for the biofuels industry in Minnesota. And, I want to see it succeed, and so that's why I say this.
Well, thank you, Senator Anderson. And
I
think that's what these standards would do. Hopefully do things again in that direction. And, biofuel production can be good for the environment. Again, it depends on how it's done, but Representative Junkie had mentioned cellulosic ethanol, and that wouldn't even necessarily be in competition with food, because you'd be looking at the most marginal lands that wouldn't be productive for food purposes anyway, or wouldn't be very productive. And
plants that aren't used for food. If you grow native plants to produce cellulosic ethanol, that's not a food crop, and you can benefit wildlife and water quality and get so many benefits from that. So
exactly.
I think you're right. I think there's win-win solutions here.
Right. So, and let's see, on the list we still have Representative Peterson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I see Mr. Lee has a question, so I'll ask him a question so he can then get his comments out. But anyway, notice it's that time of the committee. But I think we're quite well aware that votes are counted, they are not weighed. And that's just something to remember, having counted many, many votes getting to 25% of renewable electricity, which you worked on for many, many years. But that grid was already in place. But to Mr. Lee, okay, what do you need, I guess, to get this transition made? You know, I hear about feedback loops and integration studies and the dynamic analysis and all this stuff. How does that affect your pile of corn cobs that you want to use, throwing some grass into your gasifier, maybe some wood? How's it delivered? You know, you do it. Does Little Falls does it? Winnebago? What about the rest of the country? What would be, I guess, tangible for you and the producers in Swift County that you'd need to get to this, I guess, next generation? And, you know, on the cellulose piece, you know, the enzymes, getting the enzymes right, so throwing the 32 native seed grass mix into this enzyme side, how far away is that to get that to go? Or is switchgrass just a better use? You know, those types of things. What do you need on that? I mean, you're going to put the corn cobs in pellets? You deliver them in trucks and just throw them in a pile and get them in there someday? And, you know, that type of thing. You know, what's needed to develop this biomass market?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Peterson, with all due respect, just one question would have been sufficient for me.
Okay. Yeah, I get it.
Minnesota has a lot of ingredients here. We have, as I mentioned in my presentation, a lot of people working at the edge of this thing. We also are the home of those same researchers that Senator Anderson referred to with the study that said, you know, worse than petroleum, biofuels apocalypse. You know, this same topic is being discussed in California. It's being discussed in broader. It's being discussed in the broader Midwest. It's being discussed in at the federal level, at federal EPA. But what I would like to see the state of Minnesota do is take a Minnesota approach to this very complex issue, and bring all these viewpoints together and construct a pilot way to do this. And maybe what could come out of Minnesota might be informative to the whole country. And if not, at least maybe Minnesota could use it like we've done for other issues. I would like to respond a little bit to what Senator Anderson said, that I don't wish to dismiss the realness of the feeling that people have about biofuels. I feel that too. I see that response, and I get disturbed by all the negative studies. But we're aware there's a serious backlash. But I would challenge the assertion that the reality presented in the study, in the Nature Conservancy study or the Princeton study, that's not reality now. Those were studies about what may happen in the future if certain things happen, if certain choices are made. People got the impression that represents biofuels today. People got the impression that Minnesota farmers in the last 15 years have been digging up sensitive lands, plowing up CRP, cutting down forests to greedily grow more corn for ethanol. We're growing a lot more corn on basically the same acres we have been doing for the last 15, 20 years. And we actually have more extra corn now to export out of the state. So I have a real problem with university researchers who want to do legitimate research, and then when it is misconstrued so obviously and for political reasons, it seems the responsible thing to me is for them to try to clarify and correct the impression. That's the real problem. The questions they're asking are very legitimate questions. The land use question is a hugely relevant question, but spinning a nightmare scenario and then letting people say that's what's going on today and it's only going to get worse is not responsible. It's not helpful to anyone except the incumbent industries who want to go back to the past where it was all petroleum and we had a cheap food policy and that's the way it was.
Mr. Lee, and Representative Moe.
Mr. Chairman, are there any other questions? No.
I don't believe so.
Oh, okay.
Representative Fowler.
I appreciate what you said, Mr. Lee, about the, you know, all of the costs that or all of the factors that have entered into the price of food going up in the grocery store, which is really where I think the complaints are coming from on the ethanol industry that you've referred to. I've heard some of those comments as well. But I think if you look at all of the factors, you look at the wheat crash in Argentina and all of the factors that influence that, and you look at the small percentage of the food dollar that actually goes to the farmer, I think a pretty good argument can be made that what ethanol has contributed to the increase in the price of food is very small, very small. Probably, 1 or 2% of the total increase. And I don't think that we'd be getting phone calls if that's all it had amounted to. I don't think people would be stopping us in a town hall meeting saying, you've got to do something about ethanol because of a 2% increase in the price of food. In 1952, 47 cents out of every dollar paid for food went to the farmer. We're way less than half of that today. So we've got a long way to go to get the farmers where they really need to be in this country and where they should be. Nobody was complaining about ethanol 5 or 10 years ago when the farmers were struggling and trying to stay in business. And this was one thing that was helping them get by. Now all of a sudden they're making money off of it and people are upset and bent out of shape about it. And I think that their focus is in the wrong place. If you'd really look at what has caused an increase in the cost of food, the cost of diesel fuel going up and transportation, getting the food from the market to the grocery store has probably resulted in more of an increase in cost than the cost of corn going up. So that's just my opinion for what it's worth.
Thank you, Representative Faust. And Representative Moe. I guess Senator Chaudhry had a comment too.
Thank you. I think this has been an interesting discussion on ethanol, Mr. Chair. And I just it's the first time I've really kind of heard the comments that have been mentioned here about there's a kind of a PR campaign, a concerted effort to dismiss the value of ethanol but I'm just gonna have to tell you that if it is the assertion, and if it is the assertion continues, that there is somehow some unholy alliance been created between environmentalists, the petroleum industry, and the livestock industry to diminish ethanol, I don't think you're going to be successful in that rhetoric. I just don't think you are. And it's only going to confirm what people are concerned about with ethanol. I think you're much better off being honest, like Representative Foss said, that for the first time in a long time, farmers, particularly corn growers, are making a little money at their practice. And that has been a long time coming. And we can't ignore that. And I don't think, as someone who is concerned about our land use issues and some of our emissions and prices, I can't dismiss that either. I think we're much better off acknowledging that corn growers are finally doing well after a long time because of this value-added industry. And furthermore, we're much better off confronting some of the real issues that are developing over biofuels. This is the first time we've had this type of biofuel on this type of scale, and we're learning a lot. And I can't recall a member of this legislature voting against. Maybe there are not in the Senate. Maybe there is a small handful in the House. I don't even remember who has voted against supporting ethanol, because this is an opportunity for the future. But at the same time, there is no reason why we can't take an honest look at the way the industry has formed and to work out some of the flaws so that we do better in the future. There are real issues with the usage of water. And that doesn't come from environmentalists. That comes from the PCA, an administration, a department under a conservative administration. I'm concerned about land usage and losing a million acres of CRP. That's not coming from the environmental group or the Princeton Review or someplace. That's coming from the U.S. Department of Agriculture, a department under a conservative administration. So, you know, these are real issues, and they cannot simply be dismissed by saying that there's some campaign going on to diminish your industry. You have, I would say, nearly 100%, if not 100%, nearly 100% support for ethanol. But there is nonetheless concern about some of the impacts. And if those aren't addressed some way, somehow, in an honest fashion, to echo Senator Anderson's remarks, support is going to diminish. And if there's this rhetoric that's going to continue about it's us and them, it's those metros trying to get those rurals once again, if I can't appeal to someone's right and wrong on that, let me just appeal to your sense of demographics, because there's yet another redistricting happening in another 2 years. And the rural representation isn't going to grow. I'm pretty sure of that. And so we need to work together in making sure there is a positive impact for value-added industries to rural Minnesota. But at the same time, we have to acknowledge that this is a new industry, that we are in uncharted territory, and that it behooves us to not politicize it, but to seek real answers, do some real honest self-examination, and make sure that we improve this industry for the betterment of the future. Because I really want to get off. I don't care if it's Middle East oil or what. I want to get off the oil. I want to get off of that. And if we can make lower emission, clean ethanol powered by wind or solar, I think we've really got something. I think we've really got something. But we all need to work together and not pit one another against ourselves because of some geopolitical advantage that I think you're probably going down the wrong road in anyway.
And
thank you, Mr. Chair.
Welcome. Representative Moe, did you want to make some final comments here?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and the other chairs that spent so much time here. I think it was a very productive discussion. I appreciate your time and insight. I just wanted to circle back a little bit. Senator Chaudhry kind of got us to the point. We do need a mechanism as to how we are going to quantify the respective environmental impacts of the fuel that we use. And specifically, this bill, if we enact some version of it next year, we'll look at the carbon portion of the fuel. I mean, there are obviously several other impacts that are very real that we'll have to continue to address. But it will help us to specifically quantify the respective damage, carbon damage coming from fuel. So I hope that, and perhaps it will provide a framework for us to model additional damage or impacts that we can then kind of come together, rural, urban, to decide if we want to, what level is tolerable, what level can we live with. But I do think that the carbon part is a good start. I mean, I think we can all agree on that. And this is a reasonable framework that I think we can get to 10%. I think that's very doable. But obviously we need to continue to do some research. I don't mean to have the last word here as the chair. If somebody else has any input, I'd appreciate it. But thank you for all your time, and thanks to the presenters too, and people who stuck around.
I would like to represent Cornish.
I hope when we do redistrict, it starts right at St. Paul and it's a pie and it goes all the way to the edge of the state. That way somebody in the metro can know what's going on in the country, and somebody in the country can maybe know what's going on in the metro. That isn't possible. And that people in the rural do feel a little bit at a disadvantage because of nursing homes, because of transportation, because of education, and the formulas involved. And so, yeah, we do feel the threat of losing our rural representation. I got three counties right now. So, but I don't see the paranoia from these folks that some people do. I mean, I've been keeping track of it and trying to read both sides for the last couple of years, and I think they are really trying to make an effort. And some of these studies that come out are just baloney. Some of it's valid, and I have the same worries about you do with land use. I got more worries about future ethanol, the switchgrass and the ditches and ethanol and up in the forest where there is. So I've got worries too, but I think they are trying. I try to balance my reading with the granola bar crowd and read some of their stuff too. So get both of them. Eat a cheeseburger once in a while. Keep an open mind.
Representative Shumper.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Cornish, I would just point out to you that Representative Welty admonished that we shouldn't be skeptical of university research, and other people are really admonishing us, and I think Mr. Lee is one, is to not be skeptical of the research and advocacy that the ethanol industry is doing on its own behalf. So, I want to say, Mr. Lee, you maybe don't know me, but I'm a farmer. I've farmed all my life. And I'm skeptical in part because there's a tremendous disruption occurring in the farm economy because of this mushrooming demand for biofuels and the commitment. And my bigger issue, I think, frankly, you're creating a false dichotomy. I don't think it's a choice between biofuels and oil, okay? And I don't like that dichotomy, frankly. From my standpoint, it's really important how we, as governments, commit our resources, especially our financial resources, to address the problems of global warming, okay? And we're investing it in the wrong place by putting too much into ethanol and biofuels in general. That's a mistake, okay? And maybe there are other ways of investing that money. And that's why I'm saying it's not a choice, as you portray it, between oil and ethanol. I don't believe that. I think we'll always have a very limited ethanol industry, but I think there are other ways we can reduce our dependence on foreign oil and reduce our carbon emissions with other types of investments, places we could be using that money. And that's kind of my basic thinking on it. So just wanted to clarify that for you.
And I don't know if you wanted to respond, Mr. Lee.
I would love to have him to respond one quick time. Thanks for the comments. I've heard of a range of views, and I think I've learned a little bit today myself. As far as, are we going to get there in terms of climate change by not focusing on every single aspect of energy? Smart people, one of my buddies at NRDC, Nathaniel Green, says, you know what? We got to work on reducing emissions across every part of the energy spectrum. And so I would somewhat challenge that we can ignore a big one like transportation fuel and just work on the other ones. A few comments on food price. I think I'm chairman of a group called Renewable Fuels Foundation. We commissioned a study on the impact of raw grain cost on grocery store price. Yeah, that was the ethanol industry sponsored study, but we went with a company called Informa out of Memphis, a very highly respected analysis firm in the food industry. You've probably heard of them. And their conclusion was raw material cost counts for about 4 or 5% of what's at the grocery store, and the rest is related to energy, transportation, labor, all the other things that have also gone up. So, Senator Chaudhry, I appreciate your comments. I know you've been a big supporter of ethanol over the years. If there are a few folks in our industry who are sitting on their laurels and saying, all I'm going to do is just throw stones and claim conspiracy, there may be a few of those. I'm not one of those, I can tell you, sir. At some risk, our group is going forward and try to chart a better path. And yet we are up against well-entrenched industries that don't want us to move forward. And that's not an excuse. That's just a fact, in my opinion, anyway. And we're going to move forward anyway. But it's never been an easy road that we're on, and it's gotten very difficult here lately. So that's really all I've got to say.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Lee. And I think we're at the end of our hearing. And I would like to thank everyone, all the committee members and all the chairs, Senator Chaudhry and Senator Anderson, Representative Junkie, Representative Hilty, Representative Hornstein, and the others who joined us here today. Final comments on as far as my feelings on this issue and the standards that are being proposed. I would like to thank Representative Moe and Senator Sharon for bringing this legislation forward. I think it's a big step in the direction of taking a more holistic view of things and looking at the production process from the very beginning to the very end and how it affects carbon emissions. I think that oftentimes we get too focused in on one particular aspect and lose sight of the big picture. It's one of the problems of living in a society, I guess, that's so specialized sometimes. And sometimes we might fix a problem in that specific area, but then create, you know, numerous other problems in other areas. This is one way where we're going to hopefully create solutions that are good all the way across the board and don't create new problems in the process. So again, thank you for bringing the legislation forward, and I look forward to, I think it was a very productive hearing today, and a lot of good testimony and a lot of good thoughts were expressed here. So thank you all for coming, and the meeting is adjourned.